Okay, well, it's time to open our Bibles, and we are going to begin at the beginning of Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10, if you want to turn there, and we can go through this together. Jesus has been dealing with the unrest of his disciples, and with James and John particularly, because it would appear that there's a kind of power struggle going on. So he's picked up this little child and said, "Whosoever shall receive this child in my name receives me, and whosoever shall receive me receives him that sent me. For he that is the least among you all, the same shall be great." And then John said to him, "Master, we saw this guy casting out devils in your name, and we had to stop him because he follows not with us." And we looked at that in a little bit more depth at our home group this week. And then he answered a series of questions, and we looked at those too. So we come now to chapter 10, which begins by saying, "After these things, the Lord appointed other 70 also, and sent them two and two before his face into every city and place where he himself would come." He appointed other 70 also, King James says. He sent the 12. Now this is an additional 70. And he sends them out in 35 pairs into every city and place where he would be going, because he's moving towards Jerusalem now, and he has the last 6 months of his life on earth to go. And now he takes 70 and he endues them with dunamis and exousia like he did the 12. And he sends them out to be his front runners, as it were, as he's moving down the Jordan Valley to preach the gospel and to heal the sick, etc. And verse 2 says, "Therefore," because of that, "he said to them, the harvest is truly," or "the harvest truly is great, but the laborers are few. Pray you therefore the Lord of the harvest that he would send forth laborers into his harvest." Now, I like the way it presents this to us in Matthew's gospel, because there's a place there where Jesus says to them, the harvest is white to harvest, it's ready to go. But the labourers are few. Not the people, notice, but those who are prepared to labour for the Lord. And he says to them there, pray that the Lord of the harvest would send labourers. And then the next verse says, so he sent them. Because he said, you guys pray that the Lord will send labourers into his harvest. And then he said, okay, you go. Great arrangement, really. And then verse 3 picks up that idea, because it says this. It says, "Go your ways. Behold, I send you forth as lambs among wolves." So he sends them into the harvest, and he just kind of has this word of encouragement before they leave. I'm sending you as sheep amongst wolves. Because in that situation, sheep don't usually do very well, do they? In fact, they don't usually survive. You know, and you kind of get the idea that they're thinking, oh, thanks, Lord, maybe I didn't explain myself too well. What I meant to say was, send someone else. Yeah. I think the emphasis here should be, I send you forth. The emphasis in your mind shouldn't be lambs among wolves, right? Because he promises to keep them. And then verse 4 says this. It says, "Carry neither purse nor scrip nor shoes, and salute no man by the way. And into whatsoever house you enter, first say, peace be to this house. And if the Son of Peace be there, your peace shall rest upon it. If not, it shall turn or return to you again." He says, you'll get an idea if they're open to God's leading or not. You'll just know. And we see the urgency of the call here as well, because he says, you know, don't take a suitcase or money or shoes. Don't stop and have a chat with everyone about the price of bread and the state of the weather. Just get going. And he says, I'll provide for you through the people who open their doors to you. And I think it's interesting as we look at this, because we who are called to be ambassadors today, you know, I don't think we will ever be really adequately, or won't feel ever adequately prepared, will we? Because, you know, if you wait until you're ready financially or theologically or in your relationship with the Lord, you'll still be sitting there 10 years from now, because there will always be something that says, not now, not yet, not you. Always. And he says, and in the same house remain, eating and drinking such things as they give. For the labourer is worthy of his hire. Go not from house to house. And into whatsoever city you enter, and they receive you, eat such things as are set before you. So if you come into somebody's house somewhere, and they're all going to have alphabetti spaghetti for dinner, and you hear that the folks next door are having roast beef and Yorkshire pudding with all the trimmings, don't say, well, you know, I think the Lord was leading us one more house along the road, but we stopped a bit short of that and ended up here, because I think maybe lack of faith or something, you know, so see you, we're going next door. No, he says, follow the spirit, not the menu. You know, you're not supposed to be making your decision as my representatives, simply in regards to what you fancy eating. Don't go to church because of the biscuits. And the interesting thing here is that he's trying to get them to lighten up a bit, you know. And I think the Holy Spirit is saying to the church today, lighten up in regards to what we hold on to in this world. Because the plain fact remains, you can't take it with you. You can send ahead, but you cannot take it with you. Did you ever hear anybody use the phrase, that's a white elephant? Well, you see, in the ancient Far East, if you found favour with the king, some of the kings would raise these white elephants, and he would honour you by giving you a white elephant. Well, that was nice, but the problem with that was that you had to honour the king back by taking care of that elephant. And that was not so easy, because they lived a long time and they ate a lot of food. And if the king liked you, he would give you one white elephant. If the king didn't like you, he would give you a number of white elephants, because you had to feed them all and take care of them all. And that's where the idea of a white elephant comes from. And some of us have white elephants today. You know, we have something hung around our neck, maybe some commitments, some debt, maybe some love of a particular material thing, and we have something that drives us when it's not expedient, and we could be freed up from those things. And when we follow the Son of Man, there is a holding on loosely that needs to take place. Not that God doesn't bless us. I mean, Abraham was a wealthy man, wasn't he? Daniel was a wealthy man too. So was David. David was a wealthy man. But you see, they didn't hold on to those things too lightly. They were not possessed by their possessions. They possessed them and they used them for the Lord. They held on to them loosely. I think that's food for thought for all of us. And Jesus here is telling them, you know, to move fast. Something's got to be accomplished. The harvest is ready. The labourers are few. Don't get caught up. Move on. Do the work assigned to you. Be focused about what you're doing for the Lord. Verse 9 says, and heal the sick that are therein, and say to them, the kingdom of God is come near to you. But into whatsoever city you enter, and they receive you not, go your ways out into the streets of the same, and say, even the very dust of your city which cleaves on us, we do wipe off against you. Notwithstanding, be you sure of this, that the kingdom of God is come near to you. So, what we're seeing here is just following their Jewish tradition, really, because we already saw that when the Jews left Israel to go into places like, well, Samaria or Lebanon or over into the place of the Gadarenes where we were a few weeks back, when they came back into Israel, they'd stop at the border and they'd shake the Gentile dust off their feet so as not to pollute the Holy Land. And Jesus is saying to them here, this is the Holy Land. It's where I'm sending you, but the kingdom is what's holy. The kingdom's what's holy. And if you go into a Jewish city and they won't receive God, or not his word, then you shake off the dust from your feet as a very testimony against them. And they'll know what you mean. And then verse 12 says this. It says, "But I say to you that it shall be more tolerable in that day for Sodom than for that city. Woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida. For if the mighty works have been done in Tyre and Sidon, which have been done in you, they had a great while ago repented, sitting in sackcloth and ashes. But it should be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon at the judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, which are exalted to heaven, shall be thrust down to hell." Now, what he's saying is this. You are held accountable for the amount of light you're given. If you're given much light and you turn away, you're sinning against much light. It's relative. And Tyre and Sidon and Sodom and Gomorrah, they didn't have the light that Chorazin had, because Jesus went there and he preached to Chorazin. And they didn't have the light that Bethsaida had. Jesus went there as well, and he did miracles, and he preached to them. And Capernaum, it says, which are exalted to heaven. Well, I mean, that was Jesus' headquarters in Galilee. They saw the living Messiah walking in their midst and healing people and preaching the kingdom every day. And yet they would not respond. And it's very interesting, because as Jesus curses these cities, the only city on the Sea of Galilee that he didn't curse is Tiberias. And the only city that's still a functioning city today is Tiberias. Every other city, Capernaum, Chorazin, Bethsaida, all of them lie in ruins. Oh, you can go and tour the ruins, but you know, there's not a street light there. There's no shops there. There's no life there at all, besides Christian tourists. The only city that's alive is Tiberias. It's the only one that he didn't curse. And he says in verse 16, "He that hears you hears me, and he that despises you despises me. And he that despises me despises him that sent me." So, off they go. And in verse 17, they come back. It says, "And the 70 returned again with joy, saying, Lord, even the devils are subject to us through your name. And he said to them, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven." You know, this is a very interesting statement. Because did he mean in ages past? Did he mean that he saw Satan's kingdom falling while they were out preaching and casting out devils? Or was he speaking about Revelation 12, some future fall? Well, I think the only one that fits the language here is the fact that he's describing it as something that had already taken place. Because it said, I beheld, past tense, Satan having fallen. And it's more properly, I was beholding Satan having fallen. They're saying, Lord, this is great. Even the demons are subject to us. And Jesus said, look, I beheld their boss, the most beautiful angel there ever was, falling. And we're told now that he's the God of this world, aren't we? Certainly when Jesus came, it says he bound the strong man. And there is yet a time in the future, in Revelation 12, when he will be cast down to earth, which is different than his original fall, where he fell from his principality and power. It tells us in Jude that he left of his own will. He left on purpose in rebellion once and for all. And Jesus says, I beheld him having fallen like lightning. And that's an interesting statement too, isn't it? And then in verse 19 he says, behold, I give you power to tread on serpents and scorpions, and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall by any means hurt you. Now, I have an idea that that means something different to Jesus than it does to us. Why? Well, because all of them were martyrs except John. Jesus says, hey, Satan's fallen. I give you power over the enemy. Nothing's going to hurt you. Right, you know, not the lion when he chews you in the arena, not the nails when they drive them through your wrists, not the fire when they set you alight. No, I have an idea he's thinking of something different than they are. Because, you know, you and I, when we get saved, you know, sometimes we think Jesus makes us all these kind of promises of abundant life and everything's going to be perfect. And then we go out and get a flat tire and we're devastated. Lord, if you love me, why is it always me that gets a flat tire? You know, guy's selling drug down the road, he never had a flat tire. He's always got a new car and me. Yeah, I work really hard, and Lord, if you love me, you know. We get upset over a flat tire. Just read Fox's Book of Martyrs and see what believers have gone through through the centuries for Christ. I think it means something different to him. Because we major on the 70 years and 10 far too much, don't we? Verse 20 says, notwithstanding, rejoice not that the spirits are subject to you, but rather rejoice because your names are written in heaven. In that hour, Jesus rejoiced in spirit and said, I thank you, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hid these things from the wise and prudent and have revealed them to babes. Even so, Father, for so it seemed good in your sight. Now, it says here that the Lord cautioned them not to rejoice because the demons were subject to them, but to rejoice because their names have been written in heaven, in the book of life. And the perfect tense in the Greek means they stand written. And it's a statement of assurance. Your name stands written there. Your name. Your name. And it means to inscribe formally and solemnly. And it's the word that's used. It's still used for the signing of a will or a marriage certificate or a peace treaty. And also, interestingly, for the enrolling of a citizen. In Revelation 3, verse 5, it says this: He that overcomes, the same shall be clothed in white raiment, and I will not blot out his name out of the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. So, if you overcome, if you stay faithful to the end, if you do that, your name will remain written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And what that scripture means is that if you live your life down here just for yourself, if you have no intention of giving your heart to the Lord, if you're too busy to do that, then your name will be blotted out of the Lamb's Book of Life. So, your friends and relatives that live that way, do they realise that? I mean, do they want their names removed from that book? You see, all they have to do is do nothing, and it will be blotted out. You might like to ask them that question next time you see them. As for those here, this 70 come back, they're thrilled and excited. I mean, you know what that's like, because it's the same experience we have when we speak to someone about the Lord and they come to Christ. You know, how amazing do we feel when that happens? Because the greatest miracle of all is still seeing a lost soul saved, right? But Jesus says, look, as wonderful as those miracles were that you were involved in when I sent you out, don't go rejoicing over those things. Just rejoice that your names are written in heaven. And it says, in that hour, Jesus rejoiced in the Spirit. And it's the only time in the New Testament that it says Jesus rejoiced. So you want to take note of this. Jesus rejoiced in the Spirit and he said, thank you, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hid these things from the wise and prudent, and have revealed them to babes. Now, no doubt he's talking about those who are wise and prudent in their own eyes here. That's what he's talking about. And he says, even so, Father, for so it seemed good in your sight. And he continues, he says, all things are delivered to me of my Father, and no man knows who the Son is but the Father, and who the Father is but the Son, and he to whom the Son will reveal him. So notice what he's saying here. Here come these guys back, all 70 of them. And these are the front runners. These are the apostles. These are going to be the pillars of the church and the leaders of the movement after Jesus is crucified. And they come back and they are absolutely on fire. And Jesus is saying, boy, you saw the demon subject to you, but I saw Satan himself fall. What a perspective. And I look at this, and in some ways, aren't parts of the church somehow these days consumed with power? You know, it's power. We need power. So much of it is in that vein, isn't it? And Jesus is saying, no. Rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Your names are there, written in heaven. That's what you need to rejoice in, because, you know, deliverance ministries, exorcism and going down in the spirit, they're all going to pass away. But people with names written in heaven are not going to pass away. They're going to be around forever. And Jesus understands that if your name's written in heaven, you're in one category. And if your name gets blotted out in heaven, you're in another category altogether. Non-smoking or smoking? Where will you be? And he laughs and says, Father, you've hidden this from the wise and prudent, and yet you've even made these known to babes. You've let babes know this. You let babes know all these things, and yet you've hidden them from the wise and prudent. And he says, nobody knows who you are but me, and nobody knows who I am but you. And the only way people are going to know you are the ones that I reveal you to. And he looks around and he laughs and he thinks, boy, Satan is never going to be able to stop this. Yeah, I mean, look, the 70 come back and they're all bubbling, they're jumping up and down and they're saying, demons are subject to us. And Jesus is going, Father, this is a great plan. Who would ever think that you would use these guys? Satan is going to be totally confused. We're leaving the keys of the kingdom to these guys? And he's talking about you and me, guys, now. Lightfoot says that by the end of the first century, there were already episcopal, that's churches with bishops, Presbyterian, that's churches with elders, and congregational forms of church government. And these are the guys who heard it right from the Lord, how it should work. And they've already divided, and the denominations are already up and running. You know, in one sense, I'm in favour of denominations, because, you know, I think denominations have Satan completely confused. If we were all one denomination, he may have stopped us long ago, you know. But Jesus looks and he rejoices. And he says, Father, this is great. Who'd have ever thought it? You're going to use these guys. I mean, they don't even know what's going on. They're babes. And you're going to give them the kingdom and you're letting them loose on our world? Satan's never going to track this program down. And Jesus would say to them, wouldn't he who is the least in the kingdom is greater than John the Baptist. And he was the greatest prophet that ever lived. You know why? That's because you, who are listening to this morning, have more clarity with what you understand than John the Baptist had, who said, are you the one, or should we look for another? He was disappointed in who Jesus was turning out to be. He was disillusioned. You and I, we have a clearer picture, because there you sit, and each one of you know more than John the Baptist did. Just think about that. And think about this too. Satan is chewing his fingernails saying, I hope they don't realise what they know. And we're down here saying, this deliverance and that deliverance and bind this and do that and holy laughter and send in your handkerchiefs and power, power, power. And Jesus says, no, 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 no. Rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Not that you have power over demons. What a great witness. What a great witness. I mean, you know what it's like when believers walk in a church and people are going, come out of him, come out of her, you know, fall down on the floor, make a noise like a dog or a chicken, and they're doing all this crazy stuff. I mean, you don't take your friends to those places, do you? But where are you going to hear about the love of Jesus? Where are you going to hear that he loves you right where you are, in whatever you're going through? And that there's another kingdom, and that it's a place that you were made for. And the reason you don't fit in here, and the reason you can't find any real satisfaction here, and the reason that drugs don't satisfy, and sex doesn't satisfy, and alcohol doesn't satisfy, and money doesn't satisfy, is because you were made for a different place. And verse 23 says, and he turned him to his disciples and said privately, blessed are the eyes which see the things that you see. For I tell you that many prophets and kings have desired to see those things which you see and have not seen them, and to hear the things which you hear and have not heard them. Have you ever wished that you lived in the days of Moses, so you could see the Red Sea parting and the dirty Egyptians drowning, you know, and the Shekinah glory glowing? Have you ever wished you could live in the days of Elijah, when fire came down from the sky and he rode a chariot into heaven? Jesus is saying here, in effect, those guys, they wished they were us, because we understand what they could only wonder about. They could only guess at the meaning of what they wrote. But we see the full picture, don't we? Because we see Jesus. And in him, everything comes together. And everything makes sense. We're going to finish there, because there's lots there to be thinking about in our hearts this week. But for now, let's bow our hearts to pray.